via satellite from Hollywood and London, England. It's Rockline, the show where you ask the questions for the biggest stars in rock and roll. Hello again, I'm Bob Coburn, your host for Rockline, brought to you in part by Budweiser, the king of beers. Tonight, Rockline is an evening with Pete Townsend. Pete is at Capital Radio in London. I'm here in our Hollywood Rockline studio. We're using two satellite feeds tonight, one to our affiliate station so they can pick up the program, and one to connect us with Pete in London. Also this evening, we'll world premiere a song for you. And as always, we have plenty of phone lines, but just one number to remember in the U.S. Our number is toll-free, 1-800-222-ROCK. That's 1-800-222-7625. And one number for Canada as well, toll-free, 1-800-344-ROCK. That's 1-800-344-7625. When The Who split up, I'm sure most of us figured Pete Townsend would continue making records, and he has. The surprise is that he also has become an author, book editor, philanthropist, and filmmaker. Rockline welcomes one of the creative forces in music, Pete Townsend. Pete, welcome to the Rockline.
Hello. Thanks very much.
Nice to have you here this
quite
evening.
Quite a list.
It really is.
It's good to be here.
Do you have any spare time?
Yeah, I do. On the way over here, because it's really the middle of the night over here in England, although the weather is quite warm. It's early in the morning, and it's wet and damp and all the rest of it. But we were just thinking about the old nightclub days when I didn't actually have very much time to do all those things, but I did manage to make a few records, thank heavens. But now life is more balanced these days, so I do get quite a lot of spare time.
So it is the middle of the night over there, and we are going to have a slight delay, even though we're using satellite technology. It takes a while to get up to the bird and back down to Earth again. One thing I want to ask you before we play some music here, Pete, is there a white city? Is there such a place?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I drove right through it on the way out here to the station, which we're sitting in right now. It's an estate, what you call over there a housing project.
Mm-hmm.
It really does exist. It was a place that has been around since the 30s, and when we played in Shepherd's Bush, when The Who first started, a lot of our fans came from that place, and so it's always had very special importance to me.
Why White City, a novel?
That's a joke. it's partly related to to some of the things you said in your introduction. The idea of me being an author and connected to publishing and all that kind of stuff, I thought I'd call my new record a novel. I thought if I could get away with rock opera, I could get away with calling my album a novel.
We're going to now listen to Face to Face. There is the album version of Face to Face. There's also the single version here in North America of Face to Face. We have come up with yet another version that we're sure you're going to enjoy right now. Face to Face by Pete Townsend on Rockline.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Deep End. Thanks all for coming. Got a few surprises in store for you tonight. So top up your glasses and let's get on with the show.
Face to Face by Pete Townsend, my guest on Rockline this evening. As I mentioned a moment ago, there is the full-length album version, the single version that's out here in North America. And Pete, you told me that was the video disco mix from the film soundtrack. Could you explain exactly what that is?
Yeah, when I did the picture, I did new live vocals. I did a completely different vocal performance, and there were odd elements on the track that were different. I think we used we flew in a backing track which mainly had drums on it, so the sound is a wee bit different. That's the main difference, is the lead vocal.
And we thought you might enjoy that since the other two versions are readily available. Let's take a call, our first this evening, for Pete Townsend and Rockline from Toledo, Ohio. Our station is FM 104. Chris, you're on the show.
Hi, Pete. How you doing?
Hi, I'm fine. How are you?
Okay. My question, back in 1965, you wrote the song My Generation with the verse, Hope I Die Before I Get Old. And now that it's been 20 years, do you have time to look back and maybe take some perspective? How do you feel about that?
How do I feel about what? The line?
The verse, Hope I Die Before I Get Old.
I don't think about it, and I don't comment on that. It's got nothing to do with what I do now. I wrote it when I was 19 years old. What do you think about it?
Yeah, what do you think, Chris?
I don't know what it really meant when you wrote it. So, just wanted to understand what he meant when he wrote it.
Well, I suppose I meant that I didn't like old people. How old are you?
17.
How do you feel about old people? How do you feel about people that are 40 years old?
They don't bother me at all.
They used to bother me a lot when I was a kid. I used to feel that they didn't really understand where I was coming from or the kind of feelings that I had about the world. Certainly when I was 17, everybody that was older than me had something to do with a war, you know. They'd fought in a war, they'd suffered from that in a lot of ways, and I think they expected young people at that time to just be grateful to be alive, which of course we were grateful to be alive, but we didn't actually necessarily feel that we should lick these people all over their bodies in return for the fact that we'd been born. And that made life a bit strange in the 50s and 60s. It's a bit different now, but I'm sure you'll get a feeling of the way I felt if you stop in the street and you talk to, let's say, a Vietnam veteran, and what you'll feel is a mixture of compassion for somebody who's gone and, as it were, shed blood in a country a long way away for a cause which he believes in. But at the same time, you might even feel a little bit guilty about the fact that he went and you didn't. And I think that's part of the sentiments that lay behind that line. I like to think now, actually, that I don't really give a damn about age, but I suppose I do.
Also, Chris, that was written at a time where socially and politically it was a different climate, and you've heard the phrase, don't trust anyone over 30. There was an atmosphere of that back then, and I think that line reflects a little of that. In a way, that's been an albatross around the band's neck since the line was written. It always comes up. People always want to know, and thank you for commenting on it, Pete. We'll take a brief time out. We'll return in just a moment. Our numbers are toll-free, and you should call now because we're live. 1-800-222-ROCK in the United States. 1-800-344-ROCK in Canada. Pete Townsend is with us for the full 90 minutes. It's Rockline. It is indeed Rockline on the Global Satellite Network. I'm Bob Coburn, Pete Townsend, my guest for the entire program this evening. We have four more new affiliates we'd like to welcome to the show. They are WBLM, Portland, Maine, KVRO, Stillwater, Oklahoma, 99FM in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, and WAIN-FM in Columbia, Kentucky. Nice to have you on the Rock Line, and we'd love to hear from you this evening. We have a call from Steve. He's in Pittsburgh. Our station is WDVE. Hi, Steve.
How you doing? How you doing, Pete?
I'm in good shape. What about you?
I'm in fine shape. Listen, I just got done reading your book, Horse's Neck, about a week ago. And I was reading short story about the one dealing with the Baron. I was wondering who the Baron represents in your life. Is it Kit Lambert?
The Baron, right, yeah. In that particular story, which is called Pancho and the Baron, that's one of the only stories in the book in which I've used false names for people that you can easily identify. Pancho is Keith Moon, of course, and the Baron is, as you say, Kit Lambert. He's the guy who was the manager of The Who in the important years, the early formative years. Today we have a manager called Bill Kirbishley who still manages my career. Kit Lambert sadly died the year after Keith Moon, so the story is really about how both those people suffered the rather tragic rock and roll deaths, drug related deaths, and how I felt about them dying, really. What did you think about the story?
About the story itself?
Depressing, isn't it?
I thought the whole book was kind of depressing, Pete. what I could follow in it, I thought at times, I don't know, some of the writing in it reminded me of F. Scott Fitzgerald and stuff like that, with the whole social criticism, you know, kind of thing that you were doing. And in other parts, it reminded me of something out of, you know, some magazine. Anyway, it's hard to say, but I enjoyed the book. But I think, from my point of view, because of being a fan, I gave it to an English teacher at school, so when I get it back from her and she gives me a critical opinion, but I myself enjoyed it a lot, you know, reading.
Listen, I tell you something. If you want to learn how to speak English and how to write English, ignore your English teacher.
Thanks for being on the show, Stephen. Perceptive on your part to identify Kit Lambert there. We'll speak with Dean. He's in Atlanta. Our station is 96 Rock. Hi, Dean.
Hi, Pete. How you doing?
I'm okay.
All righty.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. I got two questions for you. First question is, do you plan on releasing any of your old materials, kind of like on your Scoop album? And second question...
Yeah, I've got... Sorry, you asked me the second question?
Yes. How did you feel having Lynyrd Skynyrd back you up in 1975 here in Atlanta?
Look, let me answer the first bit. I have done one collection of unreleased stuff called Scoop, which included old demos and odd outtakes, writer's notebook stuff. It's rather than a collection of... I suppose it's collector's items, really. But I'm doing another one next year called A Second Scoop, which is slightly broader and includes a collection of recordings I did, about four recordings I did with the London Symphony Orchestra as well. But that'd be available February, March, something like that. At the moment, White City is the last record in my current record deal, but I imagine that it would be released by Atlantic, which is my label right now. The second part of the question, I got to know the guys in Lynyrd Skynyrd quite well because they were managed by the manager I mentioned earlier, Bill Kirbishley, and his then partner, Peter Rudge, were the managers of Lynyrd Skynyrd at the time of their plane crash. And prior to that, they toured quite a bit with The Who, and we shared offices, and we got to be very good friends. And I liked them a lot. They drank a lot, but then at the time, so did I. so we had some good times. I can't remember that gig that you mentioned, but I'm sure it was a hell of a show. If it wasn't a hell of a show on the stage, I'm sure it was a hell of a show in the bar. I don't want to sound like I glorify those drinking days too much, because I don't. I it makes me angry sometimes when I think that maybe, you know, like right now, I can't remember it. It seems a sad thing to not be able to remember such an occasion. What did you enjoy it?
Excuse me.
Did you enjoy it,
Dean? Did you enjoy it?
Yes, I sure did. Y'all had them come out for an encore. It was a phenomenal show.
Good.
And it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you for being on the show, Dean. And there's both of your questions answered. We are with the prolific Pete Townsend. We go back to an earlier solo record by Pete now. Empty Glass is the name of the album, and this is Rough Boys on Rockline. Rockline. Thank you, David, one of our previous guests. And, of course, David is featured on the latest LP by Pete Townsend, White City. I'm Bob Coburn. Our next call for Pete is from Canoga Park, California, listening to 95.5 KLOS. We have Stacy on the Rockline. Hi.
Hi, Pete.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. I'd like to compliment you on your book. I really enjoyed it immensely. And I have a couple things to talk to you about. Let's see. I wanted to know if to play Equus by Peter Schaefer had any influence on your interpretation of the horse in your book, The Horse's Neck?
Yeah, to some extent. He was, you know, he was on television last night here with a very interesting documentary about his work. And he's an incredibly interesting guy. Yeah, it did in a way. I was very moved by that particular thing. But I think the horse image in my book actually came from things that happened to me really when I was a very young child. My parents both did ride a lot when I was like a little baby, really. Also, the very first book that I read myself with my own eyes was Black Beauty. My grandmother wanted me to learn to read, and she read halfway through the story, and then she said, if you want to know the rest, you've got to learn to read. And so I learnt to read. So the horse has really been not so much just an important part of my life, but also a important part of my kind of literary life, you know, reading and writing and stuff like that.
Did you have more in your mind this evening, Stacey? I had a feeling you did.
If it would be possible if I could get an autographed copy of your book.
Sure, you can send one to me, care of the station, they'll send it to me over here. Or in fact, in the book itself, you'll see the name of the publisher and everything. If you send a book, care of them, I can sign it. I'm very good with my with all my mail. I do my business and send stuff backwards and forwards. I'll be glad to do that, Stacey.
Stacey, we're going to put you on hold, and someone will take your address, and we'll make the arrangements for you. Thanks for being on the show tonight. We're going to speak with Kate now. She is in Burlington, Ontario. Our station in Toronto is Q107. Kate, you're on the Rock Line.
Hi, Kate.
Hi.
How are you?
I was just playing Halley's Comet there, you know, swishing from California to Ontario.
Across the continent, really. What's on your mind tonight, Kate?
Okay, something I'm really interested in is how you came to write After the Fire for Roger Daltrey. Like, did he ask you to write a song for his album, or was it something that you had written before and you thought would be good to put in his album?
He wouldn't dare ask me. it was just before Live Aid, and I really wanted to do an original song for that show, and so I wrote After the Fire, which in fact was in response to something that somebody who was organizing the fundraising for Live Aid, they said that the money that was raised for the concert would put out the fire, but the problem, you know, the fire would still burn, the issue would still smolder. And I wrote the song 2 or 3 days before and didn't really get it finished in time for the show itself. But after the show, I suggested to Roger that if he had time to include it on his record, which he was just completing around that time in July, and I'm glad he did it. I love his version of it.
Somehow Roger managed to find the time to include that song. Thank you for the call, Kate. We appreciate it. I'm being a little facetious here, Pete. I hope you don't mind. We're going to talk with Jim now in Girard, Ohio. The station that Jim is listening to is WMMS in Cleveland. Hi.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm fine.
I was wondering about two of your songs on the new album.
Mm-hmm.
Blood and Crashing by Design.
Give, yeah. Blood and Crashing by Design? Yeah, Jim.
Were you being autobiographical on those?
everything that I write is got something to do with me. when you write, you just draw from your own experience. So, but although Crashing by Design, I think Crashing by Design is very autobiographical, yes, but not Give Blood. Give Blood is much more of a global song. It's an appeal in a way that we shouldn't be over ready to throw ourselves either into war or into street fights or any kind of violent confrontation because it's worthless and it's futile. And that I think it's something that obviously we men folk suffer from, and that's why in the song I close it by saying give love and keep blood between brothers. I think traditionally in America, from one wonderful thing we inherited from the American Indian, was the idea that blood was something that only passed between brothers, and in fact that blood was something which cemented brotherhood. It's as a symbol. It's the song is just an appeal, really. Crashing by Design is actually quite clear. I think it's about how I feel that, you know, you do make your own destiny, really.
Let's listen to Give Blood now from the album White City by Pete Townsend on Rockline on the Global Satellite Network. From the album White City, Give Blood by Pete Townsend on Rockline and the Global Satellite Network. We're going to world premiere a song for you in just a few moments, so definitely do not miss that. We're going to now speak with Brian in Oklahoma City. He is listening to Rock 100, The Cat. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Yeah, Mr. Townsend, I was actually hoping, a lot of artists get their most inspiration from, like, deep meditation, internal thought, and then other artists get their inspiration from their rage and their despair. And some of the stuff you guys did seemed to come from the reminiscing on that rage and despair. And I wondered if you got that inspiration from your emotional highs or your emotional lows, you know?
Yeah, mixture of the two, really. I think, you know, what's making me happy right now, and I mean right now, I mean really in the last few months, is that I think I've just about got past that period of constantly digging downwards, you know, the feeling of looking towards the negative things that have happened for inspiration. I think you can do that constantly, and it's a very rich area to, you know, like to constantly look inwards and downwards. And I've been feeling recently that there's another side to creative, particularly creative inspiration, and you mentioned it, the idea of actually looking towards, I suppose, I always feel like I stand in a doorway, or everybody stands in a doorway, and it's not so much that your circumstances change, but you can look backwards or you can look forwards. I'm enjoying looking forwards right now.
We are getting some great calls tonight, and Brian, yours was no exception. We appreciate it. We're going to talk with Dave now in Pleasant Hill, California, listening to KZAP in Sacramento. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how you doing? How's it going, Pete?
Well, I'm in good shape.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. One thing I really was interested in knowing was, have you ever worked with Paul McCartney, or do you ever desire to work with Paul McCartney at all?
Yeah, I worked with him last week. I work with him whenever I get a chance. He's very busy and I'm very busy. We're good friends. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for him and love for him. And he knows that I don't take him entirely seriously. And he doesn't take me entirely seriously. We both know that we're getting on a bit, and we value one another's company. But the last thing I did with him is I worked on a track called Angry, and Phil Collins played the drums and I played guitar.
Oh.
And I think I hope it's a track which will appear on his new album, because it was great. Oh. But I see him every now and again. Last time I spoke to him, I suggested that maybe he come to America and tell his own story about how he feels about John Lennon, because I know that when I was in New York last, everybody in New York seemed to be very upset by things that they felt that Paul had said about John Lennon. They felt it was a bit irreverent or a bit mean or a bit ugly, some of the things he said. Well, you know, I think if anybody can tell a interesting human story about John Lennon, it must be Paul McCartney. And I think it would be very good if he could be listened to closely, because John Lennon was a terrific artist and a fantastic man, but he had his faults. And I know that we find it very, very difficult to speak ill of the dead, but if Lennon is listening to this program now, I'm sure he would say what I would say, which is that everything that Paul has to say about his relationship with John Lennon must be of interest to not just to Beatles fans, but to people that love Lennon and McCartney's music. And anyway, I said he should come over and talk to you folks.
Dave, did you have another question?
Yeah. Also, who do you think out of the up-and-coming bands in America, who do you think would probably be the most outstanding?
Well, I particularly like an Irish band, not an English band and not an American band. I like U2 a hell of a lot. I think that they are inspirational because they work in the old rock, in the old rock tradition. They're concerned with uplift and celebration in performance, but they're very compassionate and conscientious. They're very hard-working people. All that stuff aside, I just think they make great records. I think Edge is one of the most interesting guitar players. I mean that in a good way. He's a fascinating guitar player. They're great people. I saw Edge the other day. He came to see a screening of my film, and I feel a very special closeness to them, and I'm glad that they feel the same way about The Who. They feel The Who have been a part of their foundation, and it's a good feeling when somebody says that, particularly a band as good as U2.
Thank you for your call, Dave. We appreciate it. We're going to world premiere a song for you now, a song that was recorded with a band called Deep End, three shows that were done for, November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. I was told this was done for a drug rehabilitation center. Is that correct, Pete?
Yeah, I've been raising money for a clinic in the UK offering treatment by Dr. Meg Patterson, who is the woman who helped me with my alcohol and heroin problem in 1981. And I don't like to moralize about drug use or alcohol use. I just like to try and help people who have suffered from problems attached to that. And because some people, as you know, some people can drink quite happily all through their lives without it causing problems, and some people can actually use social drugs without it causing them tremendous problems. But I suffered greatly from the results of drug abuse in my mid-30s and nearly lost my family and nearly lost my life and really nearly lost everything, and was treated by Meg Patterson, and always wanted to see a large clinic available in the UK to offer her work to people. And there's all kinds of good work being done on that level. I'm obviously not the only person working on that, but I did these two concerts to raise money and to create a focus on the problem.
This next song will be on the flip side of a 12-inch soon to be released in North America. This is a version of Won't Get Fooled Again Like You've Never Heard It Before by Deep End featuring Pete Townsend.
We'll be fighting in the streets. We got children at our feet, and the morals that they worship will be gone.
Told you you'd never heard that song like that before. Won't Get Fooled Again, a world premiere of that version of that song on Rockline and the Global Satellite Network. I'm Bob Coburn. Pete Townsend is in London at Capital Radio. You'd never know, though. It sounds like he's sitting right here in our Hollywood Rockline studio, and we'll return in just a moment. Our numbers are toll-free. 1-800-222-ROCK in the United States. In Canada, 1-800-344-ROCK. It's Rockline. Rockline on the Global Satellite Network. I'm Bob Coburn. We're with Pete Townsend for the full 90 minutes tonight. We have a call from Johnny. He is in Charlotte, North Carolina, listening to 95.7 The Rock. Welcome to The Rockline, Johnny.
How you doing? Hello?
Fine. I'm good.
Yes,
You're on the air with Pete,
Come
Johnny.
On.
Yes, hello?
Yes,
hello.
We hear you. What is
Go
your
ahead.
Question, please?
I saw an interview on the TV, and you said that Roger Daltrey said that maybe that if he hadn't made it as a rock musician, that he might have even turned criminal. What I'm wondering is, if you hadn't become a musician, what direction do you feel your life would have taken? And also, what effect the fame that has come along with being a musician has had on your life?
That's a good question. I don't know. I suppose I might have gone into journalism I think if I hadn't have been a musician. You know, my daughter the other day, my youngest daughter said to me, you know, of all the things that you do, what is your favorite thing? And I said, well, I don't know. If there was anything that I would have to pick and hang on to and say, listen, if I'm only going to do one thing, what would I do? And I think that would be to play the guitar. Even if I wasn't successful at it, I would want to play the guitar because I get so much pleasure from it. You know, it's just something that you can do around your family and your friends and stuff. But I think I probably would have gone into music journalism. I you know, I'm not just a musician. I'm a music fan, and I'm a great analyst, as I'm sure you know. I like looking deeply into the music and lyrics, and so I would have felt quite comfortable as an intellectual rock journalist. And the other part of your question, I think I don't know. I think I'm doing it really right now.
Good call, Johnny. And thank you for the answer, Pete. It's Jeff who wants to ask the next question. Pete, did you have something else to say? I hear you kind of. No, nothing else?
No. Who, me? No.
Yeah,
no.
You. No. Oh, okay. Okay. Just thought I'd check there. I thought you were going to say something. We're going to talk with Jeff now in Wallingford, Connecticut, listening to 106 HCN in Hartford. Hi, Jeff.
Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Pete?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Oh, God, I can't believe I'm talking to you. You've been such an influence on me throughout my whole life. And I'd just like to ask a couple of questions about, firstly, about how much your family has influenced your music, particularly your wife. What effect has she have on your music and your life?
Well, in a way, it's just it connects with the previous question, doesn't it? The idea of everything has been deeply affecting, and I think... in 1979, 80, around that time, I was spending a lot of time away from my family, and I did actually get to miss them a hell of a lot, and I wasn't really admitting it to myself. And obviously it's a bit personal to talk about the things that happened with my wife and I. The crockery didn't fly around very much, but it wasn't a kind of a classic period of difficulty for me, but I must admit that my heart always goes out to people whose, not just that marriages go wrong, but whose love affairs go wrong and everything else. And I think that when two people make a commitment to one another, it hurts very, very deeply when they can't honour that commitment. And that's how I felt when things started to go wrong, for whatever reason. Some of the fault was mine and some of the fault was all kinds of other reasons. But, you know, you just feel that you've made a promise and you can't keep it. So on the Chinese Eyes album, my last solo album, the one before White City, in particular, that was the thing that ran through the whole record. And in a sense, the rebuilding of my relationship with my family was the whole central theme of that whole record, in particular a song called Stop Hurting People, which was almost like a prayer for for my marriage to come back together again.
Thank you for participating tonight, Jeff. We definitely appreciate that. It's Mike's turn now. He's in Philadelphia listening to 94YSP. Hi, Mike.
Oh, hello. Mr. Townsend, this is
Hi.
An honor. I have grown up listening to your music all my life, be it The Who, The High Numbers, or The Detours, going back some years. And I was wondering, in the novel White City, the album, how you joined up with David Gilmour, and why is White City Fighting the only joint production number between you two?
That came about, you know, I wrote some lyrics for Dave's solo album, which is called About Face, early this year, and one of the songs was called Love on the Air, and another one was called All Lovers Are Deranged, and one other song that I gave him was a song called White City Fighting, and that was when the idea for the White City story was still a seed, and he sent it back to me, and he said, listen, I like the lyric, but I can't use it, and I said, why not, and it's good, and he said he felt he couldn't relate to it, and that there was something a bit personal going on. It reminded me a lot of what Roger often used to say when there was a song that he felt was something. I mean, Roger would more or less, he would sing a lot of songs which I thought he wouldn't sing, and other songs he would kind of give back to me, not because he felt that they weren't Who songs, but because he just felt that they were very special to me. And Dave did exactly the same thing. He said, listen, I've got a funny feeling that this is more your song than my song. And I'm really glad he gave it back to me because it became the central song for the album. But it was one that I gave to him for his album. Must have been January or February this year.
Thank you for the call, Mike, and for letting us talk about that. Go ahead, Pete.
No, I was just going to say, he wrote the music for that song. That's about it. Yeah, he wrote the music. I very rarely co-write songs, so it's a kind of buzz for me to be working with Dave Gilmour. I started to get a hell of a lot out of our relationship in the studio too, because he worked on quite a few tracks. He particularly produces that characteristic syncopated echo sound on Give Blood. That ding da 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 noise that always makes me think, you know, we don't need no education. That kind of sound. It's very characteristic Dave Gilmour sound.
We're going to listen to White City Fighting right now by Pete Townsend with an assist by David Gilmour on Rockline and the Global Satellite Network. From the album White City, that's White City Fighting by Pete Townsend on Rockline on the Global Satellite Network. I'm Bob Coburn, and I do believe you're listening to one of the finest rocklines we've had. We'll return in just a moment. Our numbers are toll-free in the United States, 1-800-222-ROCK. In Canada, 1-800-344-ROCK. It's Rockline. Once again, Rockline returns. I'm Bob Coburn. We're with Pete Townsend for our full program this evening. We have a call from Kansas City, listening to KY102. We have Paul on our show. Hi, Paul.
How you doing, Pete?
I'm fine.
Okay, Pete, my question is, several years back you did an album with Ronnie Lane, Roughnecks album, and I was wondering, how come you didn't join in with Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton when they did the benefit concert for the multiple sclerosis.
I'd done a fair amount of work with Ronnie Lane already. I actually helped establish the first funding for ARMS, which is the research organisation to help multiple sclerosis in Britain. And in fact, the whole concert idea was an idea which I had with Ronnie's then girlfriend. It was called Boo Oldfield, and I just thought I'd done enough, you know, thinking up the whole plan. I certainly wasn't over enthusiastic of the idea of going out on the road with Jimmy Page. I regard the whole kind of era of supergroups and all those old guys, you know, dragging their weary bodies around America. It just, I went to see him in New York, and Jimmy, I have to say, wasn't looking particularly healthy. I think he probably looked the way I do right now. I've just given up smoking. I'm kind of looking a green colour. But I tell you something, when he went on stage at Madison Square Garden, I've never heard the building shake the way it did on that day. They were just going crazy for this guy. This was the man who wrote Stairway to Heaven, and this was the great Jimmy Page. In a way, it was immensely touching, because it just demonstrated the kind of affection and loyalty that young Americans have for some of the old rock legends. But I don't have that kind of affection for the old rock legends. they don't mean nothing to me.
There you go, Paul. Thanks for being on the show tonight. We're going to talk with Tony now. He's listening to Q98 FM in Fargo. He is in Moorhead, Minnesota. Are you snowed in, Tony, or did that bypass you, the storm?
No, it didn't bypass us. We got lots of it here.
Lots of it, huh? What's your question for Pete tonight?
Pete, a few minutes back you were talking about U2 and about how much you liked Edge's guitar playing, and I guess I can really identify that because I've been trying to copy his style a lot myself. But what I was wondering, you were talking about U2, or you recorded in Rolling Stone, talking about U2, and you said When you've got the energy, I'm quoting now, to touch all those people, you should make that your first priority and leave social work to people who are my age. And I was wondering, did you mean when you said that, that rock music and that rock musicians should focus more on just like creating that energy in people and not on the message, quote unquote?
No. And, that was, it's quite interesting. Bono is, well, the whole of U2 rang me up with an idea to put together a kind of community record company in Dublin, because Dublin has a lot of drug problems and a lot of unemployment problems, and bands find it very difficult to get off the ground, and U2 felt that they would like to give something back to their community, and they rang me up about it because I tried something similar when I was about their age. And I said, hey, why are you doing this? Surely it would mean a tremendous amount to young bands in Ireland to know that U2 was out there reaching millions of people with this tremendously uplifting music. And why don't you leave all this community stuff to people who aren't on the road anymore and who have done it for 25 years, i.e. me. Anyway, and I also tried to caution them and tell them that it was very, very difficult work. Nobody thanks you for it. And anyway, in the end, they came back and they said they were going to go ahead and do it anyway. So I when I made that quote, I was talking to somebody from Rolling Stone. I didn't know quite in what context it was going to be used. But what I really meant was is that I think they're such a fabulous band. And they do create such uplift at this point in their career that's what they should concentrate on right now. But listen, there they can do what the hell they like. They're their own judges. I back them to the hilt in whatever they do.
They control their own destiny. We're going to play a song about exactly that Pete discussed at length earlier on the show. This is Crashing by Design by Pete Townsend on Rockline. From the album White City, a novel, Crashing by Design by Pete Townsend on Rockline. We'll return with Pete in just one moment. Our numbers are toll-free, 1-800-222-ROCK in the U.S. In Canada, it's 1-800-344-ROCK. We're live. Call now. Listening to Rockline on the Global Satellite Network. I'm Bob Coburn with Pete Townsend. Our next phone caller is Renee. She is in Windsor, Ontario, listening to WRIF in Detroit. Hi, Renee.
Hi. Hi, Pete.
Hi.
How are you? I guess I don't know you fine, man. I wanted to know, compared to your old albums, your old solo albums, and these new albums, how did the change occur for the writing and the sound?
Well, it's very difficult for me as being some, you know, being like the central issue of the whole thing to feel any change. You know, I just feel that I'd kind of evolve from record to record and through various things. And the only thing that was different for me about this record was the fact that I made a video film at the same time. I was working on a movie and the story behind the movie, just a short movie, 40-minute videotape, which is available as a film in video stores. And rather than what I did with Tommy and Quadrophenia, which is to make the films in one case 5 years after the record, this was something where I tried to do the both at the same time. And that was the big difference. But certainly there's no change of musical attitude. Maybe we worked a little bit harder than usual. I don't know, you know, sometimes music comes together when you just walk in and throw it on the table. In this case, me and my producer were fairly picky. Do you think it's an improvement or not?
Well, I personally like your older solos, your like Chinese Eyes my favorite.
Well, Chinese Eyes is a favorite of mine too, and the thing about that was, is I suppose it was so personal and so intimate a record. I'm very, very proud of it, and I'm glad I made it. And I certainly, I think this time, having had that record under my belt, this time I wanted to do a record which was a little bit more open, a little bit more. The word that we normally use is a little bit more commercial, you know, so the audience a wee bit wider, because I felt that, mind you, like people like yourself that have told me that they like that record, it's always made me feel good, because it's such a personal record. I just feel that if somebody's enjoyed that, I've connected on a slightly deeper level than we normally connect in the rock music.
Thank you for that call, Renee. And by the way, the video, Pete's video, is due in stores in the United States this week, and I'm not sure about Canada. Probably the same for Canada. We have time for one more call. His name is Anthony. He is in Edmonton, Alberta, listening to K97.
Hello, Pete. How are you?
Hi.
I'd like to ask you, in the song "How Can You Do It Alone," the stories that you tell in that song, did those stories actually happen to you?
Let me think. What happens in the song? Remind me that I.
Pardon me.
What happens in the song, Anthony?
We're walking on Park Road, and a guy asks you for a light, and he lights up your cigarette, and under his coat he's naked and wet.
I think that happened. I can't really remember. What else happens?
You're in a store, and some kid ripped off a girly magazine, stuffed it into his pants, and ran out into the streets.
I think I've seen all that. I'm sure I've seen a lot worse. Sounds like an interesting song.
Thank you for the call, Anthony. We appreciate it. We can be reached via the mail at P.O. Box S, Tarzana, California. 91356 is the zip code. Thank you for your questions and your participation tonight. Next week, it's an evening with Asia, again live from London. Coming soon to a radio near you, we've got Roger Daltrey, Twisted Sister, Pat Benatar, the best of Rockline 85, and of course a whole lot more for you. Our thanks to our London Rockline production team, and of course to Pete Townsend for being on the show tonight. Pete, how did you end up going to work for Faber and Faber and becoming a book editor? How did that come about?
Well, I had a publishing company of my own called Eel Pie over here for 7 years, and I even ran a bookshop, which I called Magic Bus. So I've always been a fan. I tell you what I've always wanted to do was to see better books about rock music. That was my main passion. So it might seem like a surprise to people that I get involved in book publishing at this time, particularly with a company like Faber and Faber, who are traditionally well known for their poetry. But I go back a way.
T.S. Eliot worked for that outfit for 30 years, by the way, folks. Pete, thanks for being on the show tonight. It's one of the few rock lines where I can say I really learned a lot tonight. Thank you for being here this evening.
Well, I think I learned a lot, too. I think questions have been pretty heavy, I think.
We have good listeners. Thanks again to Pete Townsend. I'm BC, and I'll be seeing you in a week. You've been listening to Rockline, brought to you in part by Budweiser, the king of beers. Rockline is engineered by Jimmy Height, Jimmy Tomlinson, Jim Pettyjohn, and Steve Toomey, and mixed on Yamaha professional sound equipment. Special production by Jimmy Rash, technical direction by Jim Nelson. Our thanks to C.W. West and Kevin Stevens for their special help. Our associate producer is Mark Felsott, executive producer Howard Gilman. Rockline is produced by Cindy Tolan for the Global Satellite Network. We'll